Hi, Matt.
Welcome to, I guess this is your first time doing the weekend blog, right?
That's true. It's my first time on Blogging Heads. I am a reporter in the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine, and a long-time listener, first-time caller, so
have you
excited
actually,
to be here.
Have you seen the show before?
I have. Various episodes and clips of, you know, both colleagues of mine and journalists who I enjoy, whose banter I quite enjoy. So, yeah, looking forward to this.
Awesome. Well, we're happy to have you here. Most people know me, I think, because I used to co-host the show. But I haven't been on for a few months. My name's Matt Lewis, and I'm with Politics Daily, and most people probably know me. But if not, here I am. So a lot of stuff happening. Obviously, Republicans had a big Tuesday last week. But I guess the big stories this week, it seems like, are the sort of how are Republicans going to respond? Are they going to have a civil war? And same thing with Democrats. And you sent me a link about Nancy Pelosi's fate. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of this is sort of an interesting week. You know, 1 week after the election, none of the, you know, it's the new members, I believe, of Congress are coming next week for orientation. But, you know, there's a lot of speculation on both sides, you know, how are the Republicans going to govern now that they have the House majority, and on what are the Democrats going to do now that they're, you know, kind of the ones stuck in the wilderness. And I mean, right now it just seems like the debate, at least here in Washington, is really revolving around this kind of leadership battle on the Democrat side, whether, you know, Nancy Pelosi kind of surprised lots of folks, I think, last Friday by announcing that she would, in fact, be running for House Minority Leader, which I think took a lot of people by surprise. I mean, they expected that after the massive losses in the House of over 60 seats and losing the majority, you know, normally it's been kind of part of the course of the party leader to step down. So I think that people are quite divided as to whether this is a good thing, and including Democrats, I mean, not all of whom have lined up behind her. So I think, you know, this is really seems to be the fight that Democrats are focusing on now in terms of, you know, what the future of their party will be and who's going to really take the helm this next difficult stretch forward.
And sort of a part of that debate is over whether or not the last 2 years have actually been successful or effective for Democrats. And Matthew Iglesias actually is making an interesting argument that it has been. Basically, you know, Iglesias is saying that whether or not you lost seats, passing health care reform is such a huge deal, way more important than, you know, than saving a few seats. Maybe not, you know, a tsunami or whatnot. But am I mischaracterizing him there, or is that essentially?
No, I think that's definitely the argument that you are hearing from some progressives right now, both in the blogosphere and amongst activists. Is that, yes, it was worth it, even if Democrats lose the majority for at least the next 2 years, if not longer, that on the, you know, first that healthcare reform was such a monumental accomplishment that, yes, there's political capital. When you have it, you should spend it. And, in fact, the argument goes that the Democrats should have done more. They should have done more to try to pass cap and trade or a carbon tax or, you know, anything they could have eked out of the majority, and that they shouldn't have any regrets about that. I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting is that this is exactly counter to the argument that I think has been driving the right, emboldened, you know, the Tea Party movement and so forth, is that the Democrats overreached. They did too much. They should have done less. You know, and in fact, you have progressives now saying, no, the Democrats actually, they didn't do enough. And in fact, they lost because they didn't do enough, or they lost because they weren't able to sell those accomplishments.
Well, you know, I think, you know, part of it is the media, there is a cult of success and, yeah. You know, nothing, you know, so the media is always going to talk about who's winning, who's losing. And it's very, what's the word I'm looking for? But, you know, in other words, there's very, very little like contemplation about the long view of history. It's more like, okay, it's a horse race, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's part of the skew, I guess, associated with it.
Yeah, I think it's funny that I guess it's also, I guess, just kind of assumed that the race for 2012 at least officially begins the day after the 2010 elections. That, you know, there's no time to spare. We kind of have to jump on the next thing about, you know, who's going to be running for president, you know, which senators are going to be targeted next, you know, for being primaried, or, you know, who might have hard seats to defend. So I agree that mentality definitely.
I would say this about Iglesias's theory. I think we don't know yet whether or not that he's right. We won't know until, you know, until we can look back, because basically, if healthcare reform goes on to, number one, not be repealed, number two, to become popular, to become part of, you know, the American experience, and if it sort of radically changes the way Americans view, you know, government and what's acceptable and what the government should provide citizens, then you could really make a good argument that, hey, the sacrifice was worth it, that Democrats losing in the short term was worth it. But I think there's no guarantee that that's going to happen. But I think that Iglesias assumes, because he's so convinced in this worldview, he assumes that that is a foregone conclusion. I think that that is not a foregone conclusion.
Well, yeah, I think that the kind of paradox is that, you know, in a way, I think my fear, you know, for being someone who does believe that at least some of the major parts of health reform could be a good thing and should be given a chance, is that, I mean, I guess you could make the argument that, it's not going to work unless we try. I think that part of the danger, or at least the risk that the Democrats really run from the Republican effort to repeal healthcare reform as they've continued to vow, is not that the bill will actually be repealed. I think that's unlikely, you know, at least in the near future.
Yeah.
I mean, you even have some, you know, leaders who've admitted
definitely unlikely until 2012.
Yeah, at the least. So, you know, that's not going to happen. But, you know, that's not to say that discouraging people from embracing health, you know, if state governments you know, leaders in Washington aren't actively embracing this, you know, massive overhaul of healthcare and, you know, frankly, a huge sector of the economy, that these reforms won't work. You know, if people don't sign up for these programs, if, you know, state officials aren't excited about enforcing these new regulations. I mean, it's such a massive package, but for any, you know, one element of it to kind of fall apart, you know, the whole thing kind of needs to work together. So, I mean, I think, you know, the Democrats do have motivation to keep the faith in this going, you know, even before, I agree that, you know, we don't know what the results are yet.
Right.
There are
the other interesting notion to me is that I think what Iglesias is essentially arguing is that the public doesn't want this, didn't want it, but we're doing it for their own good. And will ultimately be repaid in the future, and that long term benefit outweighs the short term gain. It's just, I think, a bit of an elitist argument to make, but maybe we won't know if he's right or not. And stranger things have happened, so we'll have to see how it plays out.
I agree. You know, it's a policy prescription. I mean, I guess, you know, the feeling that's what the Democrats were betting on, that yes, they did think they knew better, and, you know, they were going to use the opportunity to pass what they believed would work. And I agree that, you know, I mean, it's hard to say what it's going to look like, but I think, you know, there's this period, this sort of kind of crucial period in which healthcare still hasn't happened yet you have to sell it. I mean, it puts Democrats in a tough spot. They want to be able to take, you know, they do, you know, and they tried to do this to a very limited extent during the campaign of, you know, trying to take some of the most popular provisions and trying to convince the public that, that they're happening. But, I mean, you know, the major pieces won't be happening until 2014. I mean, it's going to be so far down the road that, you know, it is really hard to say what's going on.
So meanwhile, the Republicans, of course, also have, you know, they had a huge victory on election night, but all sorts of stuff going on. I mean, there's this fight over earmark reform.
I'm sorry, Matt, I think you're cutting out for a second.
Internecine dispute. But there's another one I wanted to talk about, which I think is much more superficial than the earmark fight, but I think it's somewhat indicative of something to keep an eye on. And that is this battle that was being waged between Michelle Bachmann versus Jeb Hensarling over being head of the Republican conference. And the reason that I thought that it was an interesting battle is that Hensarling is actually arguably more conservative. He actually has 100% approval, 100% rating scorecard of the Club for Growth. And I think Bachmann was like in the high 80s. So the issues that Tea Partiers ostensibly care most about, you know, budget, fiscal, you know, spending, Hensarling actually had a better record on. But a lot of the Tea Party folks were, you know, on Twitter and whatnot, were backing Bachmann. And essentially labeling Hensarling as the establishment candidate. And there were actually a couple, really good pushbacks at this. Eric Erickson mocked the notion at Red State. And also Rich Lowry tweeted out something to the effect of, if Jeb Hensarling is the establishment, then we know we've won. But in any event, I think the interesting phenomenon is sort of how you have people who are bona fide conservatives who are being labeled establishment. And there was this notion that because Bachmann was identified with being the Tea Party, that she should have been given this leadership position to sort of reward the Tea Party. So I guess maybe the big message I see here is like, or the big question that I would have, I don't know if you're seeing this at all, is like, is being conservative and being fiscally conservative enough, or is there something temperamental about being a quote-unquote Tea Partier?
Well, I mean, I think this just goes to the question, you know, is this thing that we call the Tea Party just, was it really in the end just a way for the Republican Party to rebrand itself? You know, to what degree was this just kind of a PR move that, you know, happily sort of coincided with exactly what the Republican Party needed, you know, a boost from the grassroots, a feeling of, you know, that this was something outside happening outside of Washington, but, you know, something that ultimately, you know, is all about Washington and
right.
that will send folks. I mean, I think, you know, one interesting thing that I've seen just come out of some of the early analysis of this new class is that, you know, the vast majority of them, you know, have experience in, you know, as government officials, as state legislators, as, you know, they aren't total newbies to this entire process.
Right, and look at some of the most high-profile and, I would argue, effective candidates this cycle were people like Marco Rubio, who was a speaker of the Florida House,
yeah,
people like Pat Toomey, who was a former congressman. So these were people who were able to tap into the Tea Party zeitgeist, but they actually, and they were outsiders. I mean, remember, they were at one point, Rubio and Toomey were both long shots, both running against establishment favorites who were supported by the party. But having said that, they certainly weren't neophytes. I mean, they certainly had, they knew politics. And I don't know that that's always a bad thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it could make, in terms of figuring out how these Tea Party-backed candidates are going to govern and what their strategies are going to be and how effective they will be in terms of actually turning their campaign promises into legislation, it, you know, depending on their experience, it could be quite helpful in terms of getting their goals accomplished. I mean, in a way, I wonder whether Bachmann's losing out on that her bid for a GOP leadership post may work to her benefit in as much as she can continue to ride the wave of this feeling that, you know, she's not
right.
part of the establishment. She's sort of shut out of the inner circle for, you know, Boehner and his boys and all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's really hard to be in leadership and still be an outsider. I mean, very few people can pull that off. And, you know, so who knows if she would have been able to maintain her Tea Party, you know, street cred if she had all of a sudden, you know, over the course of time been part of leadership.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that you know, the reason that Bachmann, I guess both in terms of both the cause and effect of her kind of celebrity is that she was able to raise just vast quantities of money. I mean, that she had that kind of popular appeal. And, you know, I mean, I guess it in her mind, it would make sense that, you know, if all of these folks out there and constituent groups are willing to support her, then why not? You know, why doesn't she deserve a place in the party?
Yeah, I mean, I've argued if the GOP owes the Tea Party anything, it's to enact their policies. It's not tokenism. It's not to give them, you know, a quote-unquote seat at the table. And, I mean, I've even seen, you know, conservatives out there talking about how we need a grassroots woman, which I think is patently unconservative to sort of argue that, you know, gender or any other, you know, ethnicity, whatever, should qualify one for leadership. I mean, that may be something that happens in the Democratic Party, but heretofore, it's not really been part of the conservative thought, but I've seen more and more that mentality kind of creeping in. That's something to keep an eye on as well. Hey, I wanted to ask you, though, I should have asked you this before we change topics. What is your take on Nancy Pelosi? Because I didn't get into the other side of her, which is, frankly, as you know, Republicans really want her to stay minority or to become minority leader.
And, yeah, and I think
they believe it's going to make it harder for Democrats to sort of change their brand.
Well, it's funny because I think I remember there's just a very funny item put up that the RNC used to have the sign that said "Fire Pelosi,"
right.
That's like, all the way through the election, and they changed it once she announced she'd be coming back to "Hire Pelosi."
Right,
so
right.
You know, I guess it works for them either way. I mean, my argument, I think that Pelosi coming back could be a good thing for Democrats, actually. I think if she managed to excite the progressive left, you know, excite elements of the Republican base that have just been disappointed at the way that they believe the Obama administration and the party has capitulated to moderates and capitulated to the GOP, you know, those people who were at the time really excited about passing health care reform, if she could get that, you know, and then in just, you know, the hours after the announcement came out, there, you know, various progressive groups kind of set out very sort of ecstatic messages of support. You know, if she could serve as that kind of reminder
right.
that, you know, the Democrats could still be proud of what they've accomplished, that, you know, unapologetic liberals, I think it could help them. I mean,
yeah.
But that being said, you know, it's hard to say.
Well, that's what Iglesias,
yeah.
I mean, that's what Iglesias was arguing. And I see here Steve, I guess it's Steve Carnacki at the War Room, Salon's War Room, was supportive. I mean, are there any, like, prominent progressive bloggers who actually think Pelosi should go? Or are liberals pretty much united behind her at this point?
No, I think there are some divisions. I mean, I think there is some disagreement on the left as well. I mean, I think Mike Tomasky over at The Guardian said, no, you know, you lost.
Right.
Your House lost 60 seats. You just go. I mean, this is just something that happens. I mean, you know, both on a personal level in terms of, you know, failure of leadership and in terms of, yeah, I mean, the Democrats, just like, you know, the Republicans needed to reinvent themselves, you know,
or like
years ago
if you're a CEO
when they were lost
of
in the
a company,
you know?
If you're a CEO of a company that goes bankrupt,
yeah.
Then you should probably lose your job, right?
So. Yeah. No, I mean, that's the argument. I mean, both because of, you know, for the PR reason and in terms of, you know, just holding leaders accountable to the things that they were supposed to accomplish. I mean, you know, you saw Chris Van Hollen over at the DCCC. I mean, he stepped down immediately. I mean, he was the one in charge of making sure the Democrats didn't lose the majority and then corrected their seats. And, you know, there's no question that he had to go. So I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, what will really matter more. I mean, well, the thing that really that does bother me, though, about the kinds of conversations that have been happening on the left and the Democrats are having right now is that they're all focusing on this leadership battle in Washington, I guess both for Pelosi's position and for the minority leader position, in which there's been a fight between Steny Hoyer and Clyburn, is that it's all focusing on Capitol Hill and these kind of Washington power games,
right,
and not at all about the base. I mean, you know, wasn't the real reason that the Democrats lost, I mean, the most immediate reason is that voters didn't show up.
Yeah.
There was this enthusiasm.
There's nothing more inside baseball than a battle over who gets to... I mean, this happening on the right, too, but I just think there's more tolerance for it because you've won. But when you lose and then you're fighting over sort of, it's like, who gets to be dictator over this small, like, you know, banana republic that nobody wants, that's seen as maybe more petty. But so, it's happening on both sides, and it's the consummate insider's game, you're right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's really more, that worries me more than whether or not Pelosi stays, who will be her number two, you know, that sort of stuff. And that'll work itself out. But really, the bigger questions as to how, you know, what the Democrats are going to do now and how they're going to bring, you know, these Obama voters who either didn't come out to the polls or swung for the Republicans in this election, those are much tougher questions, I think, than these leadership fights. You sort of mentioned the earmarks fight in passing.
Right.
I'm curious, you know, at this point, you know, on the one hand, you have the argument that this is just the beginning of the Civil War between the GOP and the Tea Party, and Tea Partiers are going to tear Republicans apart if they don't live up to what they promised. And in fact, some of those promises are actually really pretty unattainable, at least politically speaking, if not otherwise, in the next 2 years. So it'll kind of tear that side apart. You know, on the other hand, I mean, do you think that this is just, you know, a kind of healthy fight that you know, is just a sign that folks are serious about making decisions and holding people accountable, and that it's a sign of, you know, health that there's this debate on that side of the party?
Well, first let me talk about the debate, because you're right. Yep. I think Progress mentioned this Civil War, and they linked to Ed Morrissey at Hot Air had interviewed Senator Jim Inhofe, who is a conservative who likes earmarks and argues that they're part of democracy. And I think, you know, he had some critical words for Senator Jim DeMint, another conservative. So here we have, you know, conservatives divided over this. One man's earmark is another, you know, is another man's, you know, Madisonian democracy, I guess. I do think that that fights are not always bad. Fights can be healthy. I think that it's very important for Republicans to show that they got the message from the American people and from the Tea Party. And some of these things they might be able to pass, and even if they can't, they have to try as hard as they can. Like repealing health care is a prime example. What is interesting, though, is how quickly conservatives are, how aggressively and quickly conservatives are really taking to this earmark battle. I mean, I'm looking at a post right now from Red State. They've got the Drudge siren, you know, going off. And it says, call your Republican senator now, support Senator Jim DeMint's earmark ban. And they have a whip list here of senators who were good, Coburn, Inzi, Ensign, Rubio, who are on, you know, on the right side of it. And they have a list. These are the good guys. And it says, here are the bad guys. And you've got McConnell, Alexander, John Hoeven, recently elected out of North Dakota. Rob Portman, recently elected out of Ohio, Olympia Snowe, the usual suspects. And it's a huge list here of people, David Vitter, Orrin Hatch. So the other day, Eric Erickson at Red State had up a post that basically said something to the effect of Orrin Hatch is retiring and John Thune's not running for president. And he was sort of implying that if they're supporting earmarks, it must mean that Orrin Hatch is retiring and John Thune's not running for not going to run for president. So they're wasting no time and drawing a line in the sand and saying what's acceptable and what's not. And I think that just as the liberal blogosphere became very powerful during the Bush years, I think the conservative blogosphere has increased in power during the Obama years. So this will throw some weight around. It could get very, very interesting depending on how this battle shapes up.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, you had a lot of talk about, at least on the left, about the fact that Obama, you know, was elected promising to change Washington, that he had these grand ideals and hopes, and people weren't necessarily going to be disappointed. That was kind of inevitable, just because expectations were so high. Do you think that the GOP risks the same kind of expectations game from the Tea Party? You know, had similarly idealistic things that they thought they were trying to vote into office. I mean, and do you feel like, you know, 2 years' time is not going to be enough? I mean, no matter how far right the GOP tries to run in the House and try to finagle with their minority in the Senate, did the Tea Party set up the Republican Party for, you know, that kind of same scenario of disappointment with their base?
Well, I think, first of all, yes, everybody should take that seriously. Everybody should assume that they will not govern for a generation. Everybody has to assume that someone's gunning for them. And that goes for everybody at their own job, by the way. I assume that I could be fired from my job tomorrow. And I think members of Congress who work for all of us, they have to always be looking over their shoulder and thinking about the people who elected them. In terms of Obama, he set the bar so high, not just with his base, but with the American public. Really, it was almost messianic. It was unbelievably high, and that really set him up for a huge fall. It was really very, very difficult for him to meet expectations. Clearly, in terms of the American public, Republicans are not highly regarded still, despite the fact that they had a huge victory last week. I think the base is skeptical of them, so I don't think it's a situation where Republicans will let the base down and that the base would be shocked or surprised. I think the base, the Tea Partiers, are already very skeptical of Republicans. It's like the Eagles song, "I know I'm already standing on the ground," or "You can't let me down because I'm already standing on the ground," whatever. I know there's an Eagles song, "Lion Eyes, Peaceful, Easy Feeling," one of those songs. In any event, so I don't think it's quite the same. But I think there are some examples. Let's look at Marco Rubio. I've been a big booster of his. I've written a lot of stuff about how Rubio has the potential to be almost Reagan-esque figure. I think Rubio could be president someday. And we talked about how he has sort of bridged the gap between being a solid conservative and appealing to the Tea Party, but also being, you know, eloquent and having some establishment bona fides. If he were to sell out and to become part of, like, the McConnell wing of the Republican Party and kind of betray dement, that instance could really let people down. But I think that by and large Republicans are in a little bit better shape because the expectations weren't nearly as high as they were for Obama.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely especially curious about some of these folks who, you know, whether they themselves took up the mantle or just had that bestowed upon them. You know, these Tea Party heroes. I mean, Rubio is definitely one. The other one is Rand Paul. It's funny because I think on that Red State earmark list, he was listed as being, you know, one of the good guys. But, you know, in fact, I think I even remember reading on some conservative blogs pushback he's received on kind of going squishy and saying,
and I think,
well,
Rand Paul, yeah. His dad, I think, is an earmarker. I'm sorry, did I say Rand Paul? Ron Paul. I got legacy politicians and dynasty straight. Ron Paul, the father, Texas congressman, who's obviously libertarian, conservative, very good on fiscal issues. I believe that he is fine with earmarking. I don't want to take him out of, you know, I don't want to misrepresent him. But like I was talking about Inhofe earlier, I mean, there's an argument to be made that earmarking is quite good.
You know, this is
as long as you're not doing the bad. There's bad earmarking, you know, and then there's good earmarking. And bad earmarking is when you like slip something into an appropriations bill, you know, at the last minute or whatever, and it's an egregious bridge to nowhere. And they would argue, well, but there's good earmarking. Why do we want to just, you know, give a block grant to some bureaucrat to spend however they see fit when we could really target, you know, this infrastructure project that legitimately needs to be, you know, done in my district. So, that nuance has really gone out the window in this debate. I would say it's only a 2-year moratorium, I believe, that we're even debating. And if John Boehner could go a whole career without earmarking, I'm not so sure why people are so worried about it.
Yeah, and I also just wonder, you know, I mean, in terms of these kinds of fights, I think I remember, I mean, this came up as an issue in previous elections, and you know, polling that's been done that showed that, you know, does the American public, you know, the broader public at large, even care about this kind of earmark fight and just the reality that there are other ways to, you know, federal grants, you know, other forms of funneling money to local and state projects that, you know, get around this whole thing. You know, to what degree are these fights that just blow up, you know, symbolic things that are really going to sort of resonate and kind of expand outward from here? And to what degree is this just another kind of battle that's going to tear, you know, through the blogs and so forth, and then just kind of be over until the next thing comes up that actually might be a bigger deal? I mean, I think the healthcare fight definitely has that potential, just because I think the issue is so reactive and will affect the everyday lives of Americans and American businesses much more immediately than, you know, something that just seems much more to be kind of a Washington technicality like the earmark battle.
Yeah, I mean, I think the public's very worried about spending and waste. They don't even know what an earmark is, most people, yeah. I assume. But this is important because it's maybe the first battle, and whoever wins the first battle will have momentum. Hey, I wanted to, I guess, end, unless there's anything else you wanted to add about Pelosi or earmarking. I wanted to talk about Mark Amender's blog post, "I Am a Blogger No Longer." Did you have anything else you wanted to hit before we got to that?
No, I'd be happy to move on to the Amender thing, which I thought was a very interesting reflection. Just, I don't know. I mean, I think so much of what I noticed about, especially the last stretch of this election cycle, you know, was how sort of media and politics that interface ended up playing out, and how you've developed this media environment in which you have, you know, kind of one scandal and form of outrage after another. And I think, you know, the role of bloggers and of, you know, sort of openly partisan or ideological sort of media outlets has played a significant in shaping exactly what that environment looks like.
Oh, totally. I mean, like, a classic example would be the Mark Halperin book, right? That came out. John Hammond and Mark Halperin. Was it called Game Change? I mean, I found out about it on Twitter about the revelations, Harry Reid's, you know, comments and all that. Mark Amender was reading it and tweeting, like live tweeting it, you know, and putting stuff up on his blog. It's so different from the way things used to be. And, you know, what I didn't really remember is that he says 5 years ago, so 5 years ago, Amender started blogging for the Hotlines on Call blog. And that same week, Chris Saliza began The Fix. And he says, back then, reporters didn't blog. Newspaper and magazines hired curators to update their websites. And reporters would occasionally post online, but there was still a strict separation based on platform. And he talks about how you were sort of like seen as lesser if you were a blogger. But there's really been this blending now, right, where bloggers are no longer people in pajamas, you know, spewing their, you know, rhetoric. It's in a way, it's been co-opted by the media, right?
I agree. I mean, it is. I mean, even at my outlet, for instance, I mean, the differentiation between blog posts and articles, I mean, it's kind of a continuum in a way.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, I mean, and I think, you know, I think it's interesting the way that reporting as well has moved its way. I mean, in as much as the blogosphere isn't just composed of pundits and folks kind of espousing their opinions one way or the other, but of breaking news. I mean, that you know, that breaking news, that the blogs have become the format for that. I mean, it's a way just to get things out there faster without so many layers,
right,
of editing and production that happen oftentimes with you know, sort of longer traditional news articles. And
and there's so many pros and cons to that.
I definitely agree.
You know, I mean, like, you know, getting things wrong or okay, so, like, here's something that I always complain about, which people don't think too much about. It's somewhat navel-gazing, but, like, maybe there's a reason why Mark Amender is quitting blogging. There's times that I really want to quit tweeting. It's in a way you're tied to this thing, and I force myself to. And it's so habitual. Like you almost have to tear yourself away to go like read about history, all these things that will make you an actually interesting, not just interesting person, but a good writer and someone who can bring context that isn't just what happened 2 weeks ago. But it's so hard to do because, like, if gosh, I bet you since we've been taping this, I may have missed something, right? There could be a big story on Twitter right now. We could be, we might be the only two people in the world left sitting.
I know. I think I missed about 1,000 tweets, at least, if not more. I mean, what worries me about this kind of new media environment, and something I've noticed has gotten even worse, even in recent months, is just the reactivity, and this kind of outrage, and faux outrage, and to scandal. I mean that that anything could really be a scandal. Any sort of salacious piece of news, gossip, anything that might be seen as outrageous,
right,
from the right or left, everyone suddenly piles on. And you've had these kind of witch hunts and folks who've been, taken down, everyone from, a USDA employee,
right,
to, I mean...
And it gets page views, and it gets links. And I mean, I've spent a lot of time writing things that were, say, like about the Armenian genocide, which nobody read. And then I've written like something about Christine O'Donnell, which people loved and ate up. And even if you try really hard to write about substantive things, I just can't help but believe that over time, it's like the Pavlov's response. I mean, you're going to be conditioned to want to write about Sarah Palin every time, because if you write about Sarah Palin, you get rewarded for it.
Yeah, no, I agree that there's definitely a reward system built in, and it doesn't surprise me. I mean, just to kind of bring this full circle, that someone like Michelle Bachmann has attracted both such such positive attention from the people who love her and such outrage is because she's a master at sort of giving out these one-liners, these sort of very inflammatory kinds of comments, and everyone on both sides will jump on it. And at this point, I guess it's the old kind of old adage that any attention is good attention.
Right.
And that even something that is patently offensive, outrageous, controversial, you will get rewarded by someone somewhere who will come to
your defense. That actually goes full circle to something I was talking about before when I was talking about Bachmann versus Hensarling. And so part of my theory is that being a Tea Party we don't know what the Tea Party is. We don't. But stick with me here. So like being a Tea Party person isn't about being conservative. That's like one element of it. It's also your temperament. So if you're Tim Pawlenty and you're from the Midwest, you're from Minnesota, and you're temperamentally kind of modest and soft-spoken, you could be, he won, Cato ranked him as like one of the, most, fiscally conservative or best governors in the country. You're not really going to get the Tea Partiers to like you, though, because you're not yelling. You're not, controversial. I also think some of it might have to do with being an attractive Republican woman, for whatever reason. Is it just me, or does it seem like the Tea Party is kind of loaded with them? I mean, in terms of the people who really have done well, who've really connected with that market.
Well, I think that, the Sarah Palin's Mama Grizzly phenomenon really, does have some legs. I mean, I think also because, partly because of the outrage factor that you get from the left as well, which I think it all kind of, whether it's criticism or praise, it feeds into this kind of momentum machine. I mean, I think part of the reason that liberals and progressives are kind of get really worked up about some of these female Republican candidates is because they're trying to, redefine what feminism is, what it is, to be someone who speaks for a woman and, they're trying to, some of them much more explicitly than others, to reappropriate what that means. And I think that is something that is still controversial and, you know, very exciting and empowering to some people on the right, yeah. And very kind of upsetting on a fundamental level, because it deals with, you know, issues of family, of gender roles, of things that are necessarily, I think, you know, very emotional. I mean, I think there's a reason that, you know, fights over stuff like abortion have you know, had such long-term traction, is just being these you know, the center of these kinds of firefights. And so I think that definitely adds something to the mix and you know, adds both momentum from the right and sort of the accompanying criticism for the left. And then you get the reaction from conservatives are rushing to defend, you know, these women from, these Republican women from the criticism from the left. So, you know, it's this kind of cycle that I think has definitely, you know, we've seen replicated ever since, you know, ever since Sarah Palin.
I really hope I live to see it the day when ethnicity and gender have nothing to do with these ideological battles, and we can just hash it out over ideas. Because I think you're right in the sense that there's so much, like, we're not fighting about today's battles. We're really fighting emotionally about the past, about history. It's like a guy who, you know, he goes to work and his boss yells at him, and, you know, somebody cuts him off in traffic on the way home, and then he hits a pothole and he's got a flat tire, and he walks in the door and his wife says hi and he yells at her, right? So we're bringing so much baggage. That's part of Barack Obama's appeal, I think, was that he was supposed to transcend some of the baggage, some of the backstory that everybody brings to the political debate. But I think you're right. And it'll be interesting to see with Rubio. I think the left really hates Rubio for a similar reason. But he has, I believe, the eloquence and the communications, the ability to the rhetorical ability to really fight them off in a way that I don't think any of the women have had so far. Now, somebody like Nikki Haley might have it, but I don't think the prominent Tea Party women so far have quite had that ability to push back rhetorically to the degree they need to.
Well, I mean, I think it has to do, to a certain degree, to how you can make, you know, if you are a woman or a minority candidate, you know, how you can both use your own personal experience and that story, and use that to unite people rather than divide people. I mean, I think that you've seen how divisive, you know, someone like Sarah Palin can be, in as much as, you know, she has a personal story that she has in her personal life, which she has put at the center of who she is, and you know, what she stands for with her family and so forth. But, you know, it's a question. I think Obama, yes, to a certain extent, he did transcend those kind of categories, but at the same time, he did use his personal story, his history, you know, his biracial background, to tell a story that seemed to speak to so many people, that spoke to people in all those different groups at the same time, you know, wasn't totally washed clean of, you know, who he was in terms of his racial background, in terms of his upbringing. And I will be interested to see how someone like Marco Rubio will choose to tell that story in terms of where he's coming from and how, you know, he can relate to the public at large and to folks who may, you know, who might not already be on his side, to see whether he can be that kind of unifier.
Well, it's been great meeting you and talking with you. Why don't you tell everybody where they can read you, where they can follow you on Twitter, and all that good stuff.
Sure. So you can find my work on motherjones.com. I'm on Twitter, which is at Susie Kim. The spelling is a bit strange, but I'm assuming will be at the bottom of this blogging heads. So that you can find all of my stuff, my blogging and reporting and, you know, moment-by-moment tweeting of what's going on here in Washington on all that stuff online.
I'm now following you, so.
Great.
So nothing scandalous. All right. Well, Susie, thank you for coming on the Weekend Blog, and do keep in touch.
All right. Great speaking with you, Matt.
Thanks.